Okay, we are back with the second part of the interpretation of perspectives on the productivity dilemma. Now we're going to move on to Ohsoni and Takushi, I think is how you pronounce it, I'm not sure. They essentially are going to attend to the productivity dilemma in a fourth way, right? We had Tushman and Benner talking about the structural and bidexterity version. We had Winter talking about maybe exploration depended in crucial ways on exploitation, and the routines kind of mattered for making that whole thing work. And then we had the Brunner and Stats interpretation, which was essentially a version of sequential ambidexterity. Right. Ohsoni and Takushi are going to attend to it in this fourth way, right? What they're going to describe is something along the lines of March, right? They're going to say that exploration and exploitation are contradictory activities and that there's a paradox in navigating them. But if we kind of move to a higher level of understanding, we can transcend that paradox, right? We can change the way we think about the trade-off between exploration and exploitation. That kind of allows us to move beyond the trade-off. I think this has kind of a nice kind of martial arts Zen master-esque tone to it, in a way that you can spend a lot of time speculating on this. It's a little bit like a Japanese koan, if you know those. And that's totally charming in itself. Could we really think about this in a different way, such that the problem would cease to be a problem? There's a hardline kind of social constructivist way to think about that. I don't want to go there. But basically, what is it that they're trying to propose? How do they want us to think about this? And basically, they're going to point to six contradictory tendencies in Toyota, right? Again, Toyota and their way of working, to describe how to prevent the organization from becoming too rigid and too specific while it's actually striving for rigidity and specificity, right? How can you push towards efficiency without becoming so efficient as to make yourself unable to innovate, right? Basically, what they're going to argue is that you avoid rigidity by continually maintaining a focus on creating variation, right? So here we kind of within the framework of Abernathy's specific organization, but we're trying to allow exploration and variation to do what Brunner and Stats are talking about, right? You also pursue goals in a way that's slightly different from conventional management thinking, right? You're consciously going to make your goals impossible based on the understanding that they lead to more learning than a purely realistic goal, right? It creates a different sense of striving to set these impossible goals. And that kind of the striving for the impossible is inherent in what Toyota is kind of advocating. There is a little bit of a literature which is very based on Japanese management practice, which kind of works on this concept of strategic intent, which emphasizes audacity and striving, which you can kind of look into if you're interested in this idea of impossible goals. Strategic intent was the term, right? So that's what you're doing to create variation, right? On the other hand, we try to, they're trying to coordinate in such a way that the organization gets woven together through what they call integrating forces. And that includes kind of trying to incorporate a common philosophy. You could call that all kinds of things, but that's kind of the idea of having missions or values or philosophies shared through the organization is pretty well accepted. Then you should try to create this free-flowing communication. You can recognize from Henderson and Clark why that would be good. but you can also recognize why it's going to be not entirely costless to do something like that. Then you want to create very long-term employment relationships so that employees reach these very high levels of contextual mastery. And you would assume also extensive informal networks across the organization. That last part is going to be kind of in conflict with Henderson and Clark's idea, right? That you want these informal networks to be very thick across the organization. You want people who know everybody else, and not just the ones that they're immediately cooperating with. I think that idea of very high levels of mastery is that's going to tie very well into what Winter is arguing, and something that I think we might tend to underestimate as we talk about, especially in Western context, where we talk a lot about job hopping and getting new inputs constantly instead of really attending to mastery of what it is that we're working with. Anyway, for Osono and Takoshi, that integrating efficiency-focused dynamic are just as are really very much tied to communication and networking. And again, it's kind of an open question which conditions will make each of these two things generalizable. Is it going to be Henderson and Clark's pattern that efficiency comes from increasingly tighter and more formalized communication, or is it going to be Osono and Takoshi and this idea that informal communication and wide networks across the organization are going to be more efficient? That's kind of an open question, right? There's kind of this, as I mentioned, the idea of coordinating through shared values is fairly popular and pretty widely accepted, also outside of the Japanese context. I'm a little skeptical of the ability of organizations to create shared values. I think management by values is kind of overrated and very ritualized, more than it's effective. But there's no doubt that they can play a very significant role in some organizations, and those organizations might be the ones who are able to transcend the productivity paradox. Okay. But anyway, at the heart of Osono and Takoshi's explanation is this idea that it's about almost philosophically how you relate to paradoxes in general and the trade-off between exploration and exploitation in particular. What they argue, at least as I read it, is that the hardness of the trade-off actually depends on how the organization itself constructs and conceptualizes what it thinks of as tensions and conflicts. What it conceptualizes as obstacles or opportunities, right? I think you could probably say that what they're saying is that March's focus is reflecting a particular state of mind, a particular way of thinking, rather than a basic paradox. It's a little more profound than what we typically read in at least Western management research, I think. But it's definitely worth thinking about. And it's kind of a... And it definitely has this martial arts Zen version of thinking about it, right? Okay. We're going to leave it at that. We'll talk more about it in class. And we're going to move on to McDuffie's argument. And he is, like Osono and Takoshi, going to argue based on the Toyota experience. And he's going to argue also that they are effectively overcoming the opposition between exploration and exploitation by looking past or by looking through the trade-off and tackling the challenge on a different set of terms, right? And where Osono and Takoshi are going to say, well, it kind of depends on how you think about the challenges and how you think about your organization and the way that you work with goals and things like that. McDuffie's response is going to be a little more practical, I think. Practical in citations, right? He's going to say that you can move beyond that, the dilemma, beyond the the trade-off by focusing on learning in a particular way. And what he's going to say is that learning in Toyota is kind of characterized by five things that make Toyota different from other organizations, and that's why they're able to transcend the trade-off. Right? He's going to say, in Toyota, learning is everywhere. Right? Everybody is learning all the time. There is no assumption of somebody not learning. Right? He's also going to say that it's an automatic thing. Right? It's not something that leaders instigate in the way that Brunner and Stats think about it, but it's something that everyone is doing constantly by themselves. Right? It's also iterative, so there's going to be a constant kind of disciplined moving back and forth between experimentation and implementation, right? We didn't talk a lot about this, but Vincenti, in his paper on retractable landing gear, he has kind of this concept of variation and selection. And basically what McDuffie is talking about is that you're alternating between variation and selection at both the large and small scale. New ideas constantly get generated, tested out, rejected, or kept. And that's going to be something that takes place at all levels, right? Everybody is learning all the time through an automatic process, and we're disciplined in moving back and forth between experimenting and implementing, right? That whole learning process is going to be driven by a difference between the experienced reality and some ideal imagined future, which has something to do, but it's not completely analogous to Osono and Tsukoshi's idea of impossible goals, right? But there's this sense that we're striving towards something. So that's going to be a way to think about everybody's learning being coordinated. And then the whole thing for McDuffie is framed by the idea that challenges are opportunities to learn, right? Challenges are constantly opportunities. And that's, again, going to kind of provide direction to the kind of disturbances, the kind of frustrations that would arise in a process, and put and direct learning occasions towards exploration. So that kind of jives, again, not totally surprisingly, with Osono and Tsukoshi's ideas. The practice of McDuffie's idea is, of course, going to be how do you create an organization where this type of learning can take place and where the results of that learning are captured and embedded in new standards. And that's not a trivial thing at all. There are lots and lots of mechanisms that have to work together to make that successful. We're going to return to some of those things as we talk about the ideas of Brown and Duguid on organizational learning. Right? And they're going to kind of complicate a little bit McDuffie's idea, I think. Okay. I do tend to believe, and this is going to jive again with Osono and Tsukoshi, the Japanese context does mean something here. I can't exactly tell what. You could probably do a theological argument. I don't really know enough about that. There's also a historical argument. Maybe it means a lot for Toyota and the way they organize, that the Japanese automotive industry kind of grew out of an extremely resource-constrained reality at the tail end of World War II. That may matter. It may also matter that Japanese labor law just has a large part of the credit for lean working so well in Toyota, right? The fact that one has lifetime employment is going to shape very much how you think about working to create increased efficiency in your own job, because unlike in the West, you're not making yourself obsolete as you contribute to efficiency. That probably matters too. Although the exact, like, what's a first order explanation, what's a second, third, or fourth order is really hard to disentangle, but there's definitely something to the Japanese context, I think, that explains some of what's going on in Toyota. Okay, McDuffie kind of concludes with one, I think, very interesting discussion, which is maybe not so much a discussion as an assertion. He says, and I'm going to quote, good processes are a precondition for good product. A brilliant inventor can... let me just see. Okay, I'm sorry for that. My just had a little break. My papers had gotten mixed up. I'm gonna finish the quote now, okay? Good processes are a precondition for good products. While a brilliant inventor can provide the product idea that can rocket a firm to success, it is through the systematizing of processes that a company manages to get beyond the boom and bust cycles of unpredictable product markets. Managing processes effectively as a dynamic capability means orchestrating a complex combination of people and their motivation. Knowledge and skill situated throughout the organization. Coordination grounded in how well underlying relationships are managed. And technology which, approached through a continuous learning mindset, can appreciate in value over time rather than depreciating. In our enchantment with Explore, we tend to lionize product innovators. Toyota suggests that we should expect the Lifetime Achievement Awards to go to process innovators. Right. It's a very, very, I think that's a very, very sober way to think about things. I am a little bit skeptical of whether it's really true over time, especially if you kind of adopt Tushman and Brennan's way of thinking about it. And in this case, you know, maybe Toyota is just a little bit of a short case, right? If we kind of take the historical view, maybe they're managing to do things successfully now. But the question is, of course, if that can be sustained, right? They have worked within the framework, perhaps, of one dominant design. And the question is, of course, if they're going to be able to transition to a new paradigm, self-driving cars, fully electric cars working in a different system, and if they're going to be able to defend their position over discontinuity like that. What's going to happen when they, right, they are getting lionized. Toyota is getting lionized as this leading edge example of how to do things. But the question is, of course, are all the things that are helping them to innovate within a dominant design going to be an obstacle or an opportunity as they move into whole new ways of operating? And that kind of has a little bit of Christensen's dilemma, right? Toyota looks good now, but are the seeds of the company's ultimate demise in the process of being planted? We don't really know. Okay. We're going to end our discussion of perspectives on the productivity dilemma with Paul Adler's perspective. And again, he's going to be talking about ambidexterity as a solution to Abernathy's productivity dilemma. But he's going to be talking about ambidexterity of a very different sort from the way Tushman and Benner talked about it. He's going to be much more in the contextual ambidexterity camp, which is also the way that you might want to think about McDuffie's argument, right? Okay, so Adler is going to base his argument on an analysis that he's done on the Toyota production system, but not the Japanese Toyota, but a U.S. Toyota affiliate that he's done a lot of work studying. And basically, Adler is going to make this argument about how Abernathy's productivity dilemma can be overcome, but he's going to take a detour through the notion of bureaucracy. And that's something that most of the previous arguments have actually overlooked. But let's just go to that and then see how that's going to take us back to the idea of the trade-off between efficiency and innovation. Right. Adler's going to make the argument very explicit. I think he's going to claim that a high degree of efficiency is going to require an organization to become bureaucratic. Right. That's not widely accepted in the popular mind. It's actually pretty widely accepted in research. Right. Some people think that bureaucracy is the path to inefficiency. But if you look into a little more of the organizational research, it's pretty clear that efficiency can only really be achieved through something resembling bureaucracy, right? Or specificity in Abernathy's terms, right? Okay, so that's part one of the argument, right? A high degree of efficiency requires some element of bureaucracy, right? Then he's going to make this other argument that a bureaucratic organization does not necessarily impede innovation, right? That's not quite as widely accepted, but let's see how he gets there, right? The short version that we can kind of get to this argument with is that if we think of Abernathy, right, it's quite clear that his specific organization is a bureaucracy, right? It's all about standardized processes. It's about rules to be followed. It's about a deep division of labor between highly specialized operators, right? That is bureaucracy, right? Henderson and Clark, when they talk about routinization of the organization, in order for it to be efficient, that's also bureaucracy, right? Communication is going to follow a very clear path. It's going to be moving through very well-established filters. Everyone knows what they're doing and what it is that they should be doing. That's all going to be bureaucracy in action, and that's all the things that are going to make organizations effective, right? The other point, this idea that bureaucracy does not have to hamper innovation, is going to be a lot more controversial, right? And that's what Adler is going to spend his time arguing about. What he does is he's going to introduce a distinction between two different forms of bureaucracy. He's going to say that there's a coercive variant and an enabling variant of bureaucracy. And then this is a little bit like what you saw in Henderson and Clark when they move from a one-dimensional distinction between innovation that's incremental and radical to this two-dimensional distinction where they get room for architectural and modular innovation, right? So instead of simply distinguishing between bureaucracy, or you could say specific or mechanistic structures, and organic fluid organizations at the other end of that polarity, Adler is going to argue that there are two dimensions that we need to attend to, right? We need, of course, the degree of formal structure, and bureaucracy is characterized precisely by a high level of formal structure. And the other dimension is this idea of the degree of trust, right? And what that's going to do is that you can have these, you can have organizations with a high level of formal structure and with a high or low degree of trust, right? So you can have two forms of bureaucracy. You can have one with low trust, which is what he calls a coercive bureaucracy, and which is actually what we typically think of when we think of bureaucracy. And you can have this other variant where you have much higher levels of trust, which is what he calls an enabling bureaucracy. And what he wants us to do is to recognize the enabling bureaucracy as a real kind of empirical possibility. It's something that could happen. And what he's going to argue is that that's what he sees happen in this factory called NUMMI that he studies, which is part of the Toyota production system. And in that context, right, where you have high levels of formal structure and high levels of trust, you're going to be able to get this ambidextrous combination of efficiency and innovation, right? And then Adler does this thing where he takes us into a Marxist analysis of the productivity dilemma, which is, at least to me, a little bit obscure in a way that Marxist analyses sometimes are obscure. He's going to look at the contradictions in the forces of production and the conditions under which production happens, and that's all fine. And the point, because I'm just going to cut to it with a quote, is that we do indeed have reason to assume that achieving ambidexterity is difficult, but this is not because the more routine part of the task set requires bureaucracy, which it does not, because bureaucracy stifles innovation, which does not necessarily... Wait, I think my papers are messed up again. Just a second. I'm sorry for that. A little bit of a detour. I think my papers have messed up in the printer. Anyway, I'm going to quote, and this is a quote that I wanted to alert you to at the end of his at his argument, right? The implications of this Marxist approach to ambidexterity are that A, we do indeed have reason to assume that achieving ambidexterity is difficult. But B, this is not because the more routine part of the task set requires, which it does, and it's not because bureaucracy stifles innovation, which it does not necessarily, but because the capitalist nature of the firm constantly risks undermining the cooperation and trust required to ensure that bureaucracy function as a tool rather than as a weapon or a mask, right? So it's kind of, his argument essentially is that you have the trade-off between exploration and exploitation being as salient as it is, being as difficult to overcome as it is, because of the nature of the capitalist system, right? I think this is pretty profound because it's pointing us to something that we take for granted, right? We sort of take capitalism for granted in a way that when we read Schumpeter, we try to take it not for granted, right? But what's interesting is that Adler is arguing that this taken for grantedness of capitalism is actually what's creating the productivity dilemma, because capitalism does something to the relationship between workers and managers, between wage earners and wage payers, that's making it very difficult for trust to exist. And trust essentially is what you need in order to make contextual ambidexterity function, right? For Adler, capitalist economies and the way capitalism functions and the way organizations need to compete in the market drive organizations away from a trusting relationship between employer and employee. And that trusting relationship, if it existed, would actually compromise the hardness of the productivity dilemma. And so if the economy was organized differently, Adler would argue, we would maybe not experience the productivity dilemma as so much of a dilemma. That can be a very difficult kind of claim to work with, right? How often do you find comparable organizations in capitalist and communist economies? Sociologist Michael Burowoy actually has two really interesting studies. They're published in the two books, Manufacturing Consent and The Radiant Past, which contributes quite a lot, I think, to Adler's argument. I'm a little skeptical about the claim that capitalism is what's producing the productivity dilemma. But there is certainly something to the idea that that the undermining of trust can be a feature of capitalist economies, and that might actually, by the mechanism that Paul Adler argues, get you to the space where the trade-off becomes harder than it otherwise would be, right? That said, I'm actually not at all skeptical about the occurrence of two forms of bureaucracy. I'm actually doing some work in this space where I'm looking precisely at the nature of work in coercive bureaucracies and finding some, I think, interesting dynamics around innovation there. But it is quite clear that you can have these more enabling forms of bureaucracy where the trade-off is not so hard and where contextual ambidexterity is actually a thing, right? We can talk about that in class. But enough about the individual submissions. We've kind of had a very fast flight across the different kinds of ambidexterity that you can have, and we've had some different perspectives kind of arguing why we should soften the trade-off, or our way of thinking about the trade-off between exploration and exploitation. My consideration in giving you this paper, even though it can be very hard to read, is that there is a lot of variation in how researchers think about how to overcome the productivity dilemma. And there are quite a few answers to that question. And they are all going to be essentially challenging the way that March would have us think about the trade-off between exploration and exploitation, right? Having read this paper, it's quite clear that we shouldn't be thinking about the trade-off as being a hard one, right? We should be thinking about this as a balance between different concerns, and that there are numerous ways that you can move beyond the trade-off, right? Okay, overall though, we're going to see a few different ideas running across the six arguments. One is that, of course, that the productivity dilemma is not necessarily real, right? Depending on how you see it, it's either an effect of a particularly Western propensity to think about the world in opposites or paradoxes. It might be an effect of how you think about employees, whether you think of them as active learners or as more docile automatons. It might also be an effect of an exaggeration of the importance of product innovation. And even amongst those who recognize the existence of a dilemma, right, who recognize that there is a hard trade-off, you're going to see different angles on how you can approach ambidexterity, how you can, while accepting the trade-off, try to work around it. You can do that with Bruner and Stats in a sequential mode. You can think of it as simultaneous and contextual with Adler and McDuffie, or you can think of it as simultaneous and structural with Tushman and Benner. They are all going to have different responses to the role of leadership. One is going to take this very directly intervening role, such as Bruner and Stats would argue, or you can have this more strategically distant, organizationally designing version of management in Tushman and Benner. Or you can have a framework setting, kind of context creating a manager in Adler's version. Right. So one way to think about this is as an unfinished discussion, right? It would be hard to get to the point where we could say that there are just very few data points here, and there's so much focus on Toyota, and so it's just very hard to know what's going to be the case, right? I think we can do a little better than that. One synthesis I think is the one that Tushman himself has actually argued for, not in this piece but in others, that essentially contextual ambidexterity is a way to approach the productivity dilemma during periods of incremental change. But then when you get into these eras of ferment, you really do need structural ambidexterity in order to manage these large-scale technology transitions. That's where it's during the eras of ferment that management, top management, is really justifying the kind of wages that they get. So you have this intertemporal switching between different forms of simultaneous ambidexterity. And there are different ways to conceptualize that, but essentially this strategic challenge is going to be to change the organization's individual part from one state to another and to identify challenges soon enough that you can make the organizational switch in a timely manner to get in on the new S-curves, right? Okay, I think with that, we're going to put the perspectives on the productivity dilemma to the side, and then we're going to turn to absorptive capacity.